This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are continuing our coverage of the coronavirus and its impact on Massachusetts today. Later in the hour, we will have a panel of healthcare experts who will take your calls on the coronavirus. The number for those calls is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll talk with Congressman Seth Moulton, who is sheltering, self-quarantining at home right now after showing symptoms for the coronavirus. But just in the last hour, we heard from Governor Charlie Baker, who announced new health care options for those struggling with homelessness. He announced the reopening of Newton Pavilion, which was once part of Boston Medical Center, in partnership with a number of area shelters. One of the partner shelters is Pine Street Inn, and joining us now on the line is Lyndia Downey. She is the president and executive director of Pine Street. Lyndia, welcome to Radio Boston. Welcome, Lyndia.
Yes. Good to hear you. Good to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Let's start with what we heard from the governor just last hour. What more can you tell us about this new initiative with the Newton Pavilion?
Well, the governor and certainly the city of Boston have been working very hard to identify other sites, both for quarantine and as a way to get people out of crowded shelters so we can do some social distancing. Newton Pavilion in particular will be used, we hope, for quarantine and for people who are homeless who, you know, don't require hospital-level care but require some care and, of course, can't be cared for at home because they don't have a home. So it's terrific, and we're thrilled about it. And we are really Boston Medical Center and Healthcare for the Homeless will be operating that facility, and the three of us, as well as the city shelter, will work together to get a referral process going to get people into those beds.
So I know this is a simple question, but how bad is the need for that excess capacity? You know, what's the situation right now at Pine Street?
Well, I would say, you know, it's still relatively cold at night, and so the city of Boston is still in winter overflow, which means all of our beds in the city are full, and then we are also have cots and mats on our in our lobbies, both we do and the city shelter does. So that means in our men's inn, for example, there's over 400 men sleeping there every single night. We can't do the kind of distance in the beds we'd like without, you know, turning people away, and at the moment we don't want to do that. So this will provide enormous relief in terms of getting people out and getting getting the crowding to a manageable level where we can do some distancing between beds, where we can do some more distancing at dinner time. So city's also working on some other sites as well, and I think we're going to need probably, you know, most of what's on the list.
Lyndia, Pine Street put out a statement today saying that it's been, quote, informed that an individual who stayed at Boston area shelters, including Pine Street, has tested positive for COVID-19, end quote. What can you tell us about that?
So we do have a long-term guest who tested positive. He is in the hospital at the moment, and we are doing have been doing since yesterday contact tracing, both to, you know, identify any of our staff who had sustained contact with that person, as well as any other guests who had sustained contact.
Is that requiring any other extra precautions for your staff or other guests?
The precautions really are related to how much time a staff person or another guest spent with this person. It's 15 minutes of sustained contact. And so we had a couple of staff, and they're both fine and will most likely, I think, quarantine at home. We had a number of guests who slept near that, the person who turned out to be positive, and we've been in touch with them. And we are working to get them quarantined. So it's complicated when you're homeless because if these people had a place to go, we would say go home and self-quarantine for 14 days. And if you get any symptoms, you know, call your primary care provider. That's not an option for the people we serve. So we are working with Healthcare for the Homeless to help them quarantine in the medical tent down on Southampton Street. But the reason we're looking for other buildings, Tiziana, is because we know that there will be more cases and we will need more quarantine space.
Yeah, to that point, what are other unique challenges people might not understand that your guests or other people experiencing homelessness face with the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, I think, you know, the first probably and biggest challenge is we have many people with underlying medical conditions. In fact, in some cases, people are with us because something, they had a medical crisis and lost their job and ended up homeless. And so we've got people there. We've, you know, in that category, we've got quite a few people who are elderly. And so what is different, of course, is that the people we're working with have no other options. They can't self-quarantine. They can't go rent a hotel for 2 weeks and self-quarantine. They don't have access all day, every day to hand washing and to basic sanitation. So their options are really, really limited. It's why we're scrambling so much to try and come up with some other potential solutions on this.
You know, you mentioned a moment ago that some of the people who are guests of yours are there as a result of having lost a job. You know, we got news today that more than 3 million people filed for unemployment. Governor Baker talked about a 15-fold increase here in the Commonwealth. Are you concerned about the impact that's going to have on the homeless population and on the number of guests who may need your services?
Yes, it's going to have an impact two ways. One is many people who are staying with us, you know, are working in restaurants. They're working in, you know, gig economies. Maybe they're driving for Uber and they're already on the edge. If they lose their job, they're not going to be able to save the money to get out of shelter, which is going to, again, back us up. I do expect, you know, for people who were on the edge and one paycheck away, it's not going to take much. And as good of a job as everybody can do on getting unemployment checks in people's hands, that's going to take some time given the volume. So, you know, the ripple effect, if your landlord will give you a pass for a few months, great. If not, it could drive more people into homelessness. But I have to tell you right now, in Boston, we are full and we don't have additional capacity yet if more people show up.
Are you saying that the baseline before the pandemic even began was Boston was full?
Yes, exactly. Boston was full, and not just full, but in overflow, as I said. Now, the weather will help a little bit. We do have some people who will say, weather's a little better, you know, I'll take my chances outside. We'll see. You know, the risk of that, of course, is, you know, outside you have even fewer options for hand sanitizing and other sanitation. If you're out there by yourself, maybe you'll be okay. But if you're out there, you know, sleeping in an encampment with 10 other people, that's not so good.
So, Lyndia, what do shelters like Pine Street and others need right now, especially from the government, from regular people, from neighbors and members of the community?
I would say there's some very immediate needs, which we're working really closely with the city and the state on. First of all, how do we find other sites so that we can get people out of shelter, both quarantine and just people that are at risk? So that's really very on top of front of the list. I think the second piece for us is, you know, we're in desperate need of drivers to transport people to testing, to transport food to some of our other sites. We have vacancies. If people are looking for jobs, we actually have quite a few vacancies in our kitchen. You know, we're still producing 3,000 meals a day in our kitchen, but we've got some staff out in the kitchen because of quarantine. So, you know, if people are unemployed and you're looking for a job, call us, especially in the food services area. I think, you know, we've asked all of our volunteers not to come in during this pandemic, and we are heavily, heavily reliant on our volunteers to serve meals and to really help us in a whole variety of ways. You know, they're really part of the operation. So that strained us, so we're looking for people to help us potentially, you know, serve meals. You know, financial support, this is going to stretch everybody. There isn't a nonprofit or a for-profit that isn't going to take a hit on this. So I think, you know, it's all of the above, frankly.
Lyndia, how bad is the hit going to be from the nonprofit community?
Well, I think, you know, there's the fact that our expenses have gone up significantly in the past few weeks. Hazard pay for frontline staff, having to, you know, purchase more food because our volunteers aren't bringing in food and we don't have as many food donations. So we've got seriously added expenses that weren't budgeted for. We're going to lose some revenue in some of our treatment programs because we've had to cut the census in half because of social distancing. So the loss of revenue and the increased expenses is, you know, the unfortunately perfect storm, and I think lots of other nonprofits are going to be in the same place. You know, we've canceled our big fundraising event, our one and only fundraising event that we do every year. We've had to cancel it. So all of those things together are really going to add up to increased expense, revenue loss, and lots of nonprofits are in the same boat.
We have thousands of empty dorm rooms all around the city, Lyndia. Should we be thinking about that?
Yes, dorms are on the list. Yep, the mayor's looking at dorms now, and I think in very short order we will be talking about getting some dorms up and running as spaces so that people can get out of shelter.
And bring us your resident voices, your guest voices. What are you hearing from them?
You know, I think, you know, I've said this since this has started. This will not be a virus of equity. The poorest people will get hit the hardest because they always get hit the hardest because they were already in a very tough situation to begin with. I would say people are very anxious. People are nervous. I think people's mental health is on a fine thread at the moment. I think people feel cooped up, even though, you know, we've opened our building all day. People can really use the entire building. We're trying to space people out as much as we can. And you know, it's great that we can do that. On the other hand, everything else is closed. And so if you're homeless and you do things during the day, you don't have those options anymore. So I just think people are feeling anxious and tense. Having said that, the guests, as always, rise to the occasion. I think they're doing the best they can. We started screening last week. People have been really patient with the screening because it's taking a long time. And I think grateful that we're doing it. We've heard a lot of comments about, we're glad you're doing this, and, you know, I don't mind waiting in line for an extra, you know, 40 minutes while you screen the people in front of me. So I think, you know, it's been mixed, but it's a very tough situation. It was tough before this, and this is just going to be decimating for some of our guests.
Lyndia Downey is the president and executive director of Pine Street Inn. Thanks for being here, Lyndia.
Thank you.
As the coronavirus pandemic upends life as we know it, everyone's at risk. Especially vulnerable are people behind bars who risk falling ill out of the public eye. A new series from WBUR's investigations team finds people at county correctional facilities are also at the mercy of a system that has failed many before. The series, Dying on the Sheriff's Watch, tells the stories of people who suffered from dire medical conditions in Massachusetts county jails and were often ignored or mistrusted, suffering fatal consequences. Earlier, we spoke with WBUR's investigations team, investigative reporter Beth Healy and senior investigative editor and reporter Christine Willemson. I asked Christine how the investigation began.
Well, it started with just a curiosity I had of how many people had died at the Suffolk County Jail and of what. Once I got some basic information back, I saw one family in particular where the cause of death wasn't known still. So I just started digging deeper and found a much bigger problem across the state. Beth jumped in and started reporting with me, and we started interviewing more families of the people that had died.
Beth, it turned into a four-part series. What's the big lesson from this?
Well, what we found out is that it can be dangerous to get sick in jail. We found inmates who were suffering and sometimes dying of things that might not have killed them on the outside. And often their complaints were ignored. There's something in jail called malingering, and it's difficult for guards to seemingly always understand whether people are faking or something's really wrong. And sometimes they just waited too long to call 911 in an emergency.
Beth, how many people are we talking about here in Massachusetts? What are the numbers?
So we found that 195 people had died in Massachusetts over the last decade. And this number is actually not as easy to find as you might think. We pulled together a database by sending out records requests to sheriffs across the state. And the information we got from them varied really widely. Of the 195, we found that 127 of those had died of medical causes.
Christine, inmates have a constitutional right to health care here. What does that look like? What do those rights entail?
Well, you're right. Inmates do have a right to health care, and it's supposed to kind of look like something you would find in the community for you or I. In the case of an inmate, if someone gets sick, What they have to do is they fill out like a medical slip. It's called a sick slip, and it's basically a note where you tell your symptoms, what's going on with you, why you're not feeling well. You put it in a box, essentially, and a nurse or a medical provider is really supposed to look at that within 24 hours, and we found that that didn't happen all the time. And then there's medical emergencies, right, just like you or I might have, and guards and medical staff, you know, failed to recognize some of those situations. And it's so different than, you know, the way you and I get medical care, because in jail, you don't get to call 911, and you certainly don't get to pick your medical provider and if and when you get to see a doctor.
So tell us a story to illustrate this, Christine, an example of when someone died and didn't get the attention that they needed.
Sure. One of the cases we highlighted was at the Worcester County Jail, a man named Michael Ramey. He's 36. He grew up in Randolph, and he was telling nurses he couldn't walk, he couldn't see, he couldn't hear. He would beg for help. He had headaches nonstop. They were terrible. This was in July 2016, and his family lawsuit says that basically the jail staff didn't believe him. Here's Hector Pinero, the attorney for the family.
Even though this kid is screaming that he has a neurological condition that's raging, everybody writes it off. He's faking that he can't see. He's faking that he cannot hear.
It would turn out Ramey had a type of meningitis, an infection of the brain that, when we talked to medical people, said should have been identified earlier, and it can be treated by antibiotics. About a couple weeks later, Ramey died.
Wow. Beth, you talk about some people who died really pretty soon after arriving in jail. What happened there?
There's one woman that whose story we told. Her name's Kelly White. She was 42 years old. She'd been picked up on a warrant by police in 2012 for owing $200 in court fees in New Bedford. You see this a lot. A lot of, you know, two-thirds of people in jail are still awaiting trial. They brought her to the Bristol County Jail, and she was sick. She was withdrawing from drugs. And underlying that, she had a heart infection that nobody found out about until it was too late. She actually died waiting in a maintenance hallway in the jail, waiting for a ride to the infirmary. Here's her sister, Abigail Mulstay.
It's frustrating because there is a window where she possibly, you know, could have been helped. So it's like, what the hell went on where they're like, good to go, back to this cold cell alone.
Ugh, 4 days after she arrived.
Yeah, a lot of people coming off the street into jail are in poor health. Many of them haven't seen a doctor in a long time. Many are coming off drugs and have other problems. Here's Kelly's sister, Abigail Mulstay, again.
Yeah, it's a human life. They come with family and friends and history. They come with what could have ends.
We also spoke with a retired judge who had actually signed the default warrant on Kelly White. Her name's Bernadette Sabra, and she was pretty shocked to find out that Kelly had died in jail.
There are brothers and sisters and our sons and daughters and cousins. And I think a lot more people have been touched by someone that they know who's been in the throes of an addiction. So hopefully that will bring a little more understanding, because certainly if they thought their son or daughter was in a jail, they would want to have them get the help and the medical attention that they should have.
Now, Christine, on the second part of the series, you focus on private health care companies, in particular NAFCARE, who handles health care coverage for Suffolk County Corrections and some others. Tell us a little more about these private companies. How long have county jails been working with them? What's the level of care that they provide?
Sure. So probably in about the last decade, we've seen an increase in private companies coming into jails and offering health care. In Massachusetts, about half of the 13 sheriffs that run jails hire these for-profit companies to provide medical care. What we did is we looked at the contracts themselves. Those are between the jails and the for-profit providers, and found some really interesting information. Some of the contracts showed bonuses and incentives, even caps and penalties. In the example of Suffolk County Sheriff, we found a contract in which there was a penalty for NAFCARE if it went over a certain amount of trips. For example, if inmate trips to the hospital or a medical specialist went over 80 per month, NAFCAIR had to pay the sheriff a $100 penalty per trip. It sounds obvious, but this can create a conflict of interest in jails. Here's Andrew Harris, professor of criminology and justice studies for the University of Massachusetts Lowell.
These companies are inherently motivated to make money. I mean, that's why they're in the business. There's a calculus that takes place. There are going to be situations where care is going to be withheld, very often with negative consequences for the patients.
So then one wants to ask, what about the sheriffs? What did they say when you asked them about 195 deaths over 10 years?
Sheriffs are really the ones who are responsible for the people coming into their jails. They are literally responsible under the law for the care and custody of these people. When we asked a number of the sheriffs, they said, well, you know, gee, we don't do the health care. This company that we hire does the health care. And this is one of the issues, is that these private companies are almost a middleman. They're in between the sheriff and the inmates who are getting this care. And in some ways, it gives sheriffs a little bit of distance where they can say, well, you know, my employees didn't do that. Some other employees made a mistake taking care of this inmate.
And I would also just add that many of the sheriffs we talked to said, hey, we don't want anyone dying in our jails. But when we asked for details on some of these cases, they wouldn't provide any. You know, the records even that we got were heavily redacted. So it was really hard to tell, you know, the details of the deaths and what happened and if there was culpability.
And what about recourse? Has there been any for families of these inmates?
Well, there's been settlements. Most of them are secret. Some are not. With the Ramey case, for example, that's still pending. That's a lawsuit that's ongoing, and we'll be reporting that out. But keep in mind, these cases can drag on for years.
So tomorrow, in the last day of our series, you're going to hear about the Davison family and their long fight for justice. It took many, many years of fighting in court, hiring lawyers, gathering evidence. It is not for the faint of heart. And with so many of the details in these death cases in the jails, it is really hard for families to hold sheriffs accountable.
Christine, Beth, we are in a public health crisis now. Coronavirus is here. What is at stake?
Well, you're right. It is here. And it's a serious issue that a lot of sheriffs are contemplating right now. We looked around the country to see where it was being infiltrated in jails and prisons. And earlier this week, we already had up to 80 inmates and employees at jails and prisons across 18 states being infected or tested positive. So that's just the start of it. Many predict it's going to get much worse.
And, you know, some of the jails are actually even talking about releasing inmates. This is happening around the country to sort of cut down on their population and let some pretrial or people with vulnerable health issues out of the jails. Here in Massachusetts, in Middlesex, Sheriff Peter Katugian is releasing some inmates. We have other sheriffs who are against that and feel that they can take care of the inmates better themselves at their jails.
Investigative reporter Beth Healy and senior investigative editor reporter Christine Wilmson of WBUR's investigations team, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
It's time for us to take your calls about the coronavirus with our daily panel of health experts. What are your questions? What are your worries? What do you need to know? And also today, if you're a healthcare worker, a healthcare provider who may be listening, what has the outbreak been like for you and for those you care for those you live with? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Returning to us today via Skype is Nadia Abuelazam, assistant professor and epidemiologist at the Connell School of Nursing at Boston College. Thanks for returning to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also on the line is Dr. Sharon Wright, Senior Medical Director of the Division of Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Welcome to Radio Boston, Dr. Wright.
Thank you.
So, Nadia Abuelazam, jobless unemployment claims are at a record high. We've talked about it a couple times already this hour. With insurance tied to unemployment, to employment in this country, what does it mean for people's health care and access to health care at this time when what is causing their unemployment is also why they need health care so badly?
Yeah, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, especially for our vulnerable populations. You can imagine that people who are perhaps working hourly wages or in jobs where they don't get health care, may have sort of other social determinants that may cause them to be more at risk for coronavirus. So this is really a perfect storm in the sense that those who are most vulnerable are likely not to have insurance and are therefore not likely to get the care that they need for the infection that they're most vulnerable to. And this is something that I think really needs attention. And there are people who are working on this, but I think more minds need to come together to address this issue.
And Dr. Sharon Wright, before we go to calls, the Boston Globe is reporting today that more than 100 Boston area hospital workers have tested positive, and that actually community spread rather than their work could be the cause in that spike. How do we think about that?
I think, unfortunately, it's not too surprising. Healthcare workers, like everyone else, do live in the community, and our families and everyone else are just as likely to give it to us. In fact, we know that influenza spreads very efficiently in households more than it does in the rest of the community, and hopefully some of the social distancing and the stay-at-home orders will help with that. But I think also we need to think about healthcare as a family of itself, and healthcare workers are often unable to socially isolate in the way that we're actually asking the public to do. So when we're sitting in workrooms and in nurses' stations and trying to document care and look up test results and provide care to all the people who need it most, we are often unable to sit 6 feet apart. And I think, some people who are what I would call pre-symptomatic and don't know that they're sick yet, they may actually be passing it to others who they work with and care about.
Let's take some calls now. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Alex on the line from Jamaica Plain. Alex, what's your question?
Hi. You guys just teed me up pretty well with your conversation.
Good.
My question is, we've heard so much about a long asymptomatic contagious period, and we just heard from all these high-risk communities, homeless individuals, incarcerated individuals, the people who work for those communities, and you, medical staff. So how soon might we ever see testing widely available for people who are at risk, even if they're asymptomatic?
Let's turn.
This is Boston, and from what I hear, we have a pretty good healthcare system.
I've heard that too, actually, Alex. So let's turn to Nadia Abuelazam on this. Nadia.
I wish I had the answer to this question because I think it really would ease the minds of many. The reality is that we are working to increase our testing capacity. I know that the Department of Public Health is working on this, but right now, as you said, the people who are most likely to receive a test are those who are presenting with symptoms, unfortunately.
Dr. Sharon Wright, we had a caller call in yesterday, and we were just about to get the caller's answer when we had to go to live coverage of the governor's daily press briefing, which is quite important, on the coronavirus. So I thought I'd bring it back today. The caller wanted to know whether ultraviolet light and or air filters could have any effect on the virus and were something one should consider as part of your sort of package of things you're doing to try to stay safe.
And you're talking about for people at home?
Yes.
I mean, I think, I've told my family and our neighbors that, you know, taking walks outside in the sunlight, UV and wide open spaces with good ventilation are good ways to get some exercise and not be trapped in your house while absorbing some of those UV rays, which are good for killing any kind of bacteria or viruses. So viruses, I suppose, more. But I guess I would say that we are looking at that in hospitals. You know, we face a shortage of personal protective equipment, and we're looking at all different ways to reuse them safely, including disinfection and sterilization, which can include UV. So things like that are useful. You know, in hospitals, there are rooms that have extra HEPA filtration, and all the air in hospitals is filtered to one extent or another. And so we do use air filtration. But whether people need to do that in their homes, I think, would be a step that I think most of us probably wouldn't recommend at this point.
In terms of supplies, Nadia Abuelazam, we heard from Governor Baker's team yesterday that 750,000 pieces of personal protective equipment had been received from the national stockpile. And today in their briefing, they talked about roughly 65 deliveries had been made. How do you characterize the urgency of the need for these supplies, given the pace of usage of them and the pace of the spread of the virus in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, I was just talking to one of my nursing students today who's working, and she told me that when she gets to her job in the morning, She's given one mask and it's supposed to last her the entire day. You know, she doesn't get the opportunity to get, grab another mask if she needs one.
And so is that normal? So for the average person who doesn't work in that environment, what should we think when we hear the sentence you just said?
Well, I think Dr. Wright would be better to answer that question.
All right. So let me let you finish then. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. And then we'll go to Dr. Wright.
No, I think it's fantastic that we're working on gathering more supplies. I think it would have been fantastic a week ago. I think it'll be great to grab them, to get them in our hospitals today. I think the more that we have, the better we can protect our healthcare workers, the better the overall outcomes will be. As we know, they are the people at the front lines who are making a difference in people's lives.
Dr. Wright?
So in terms of the one mask issue, I think, you know, we don't have enough personal protective equipment. And many of us, for reasons that I mentioned about the inability to do social distancing in the healthcare setting, in addition to protecting patients from healthcare workers and vice versa, we need to use that equipment every day. If you think about how many healthcare providers are patient-facing, I mean, in my institution alone, only looking at the healthcare workers in the medical center who actually treat patients or are in the patient care areas, but not necessarily clinicians, that's over 5,000 people. So even just giving one person each day one mask is a lot. And we would burn through that, I think, in Massachusetts quite quickly. But every little bit helps, and we're glad to get it. I would also say that you're given one mask in the morning, but if that mask becomes soiled, if you can't breathe through it anymore, if for some reason it gets contaminated while you're delivering care, then you would need another mask. And we also change different types of masks depending on the type of procedure we're doing. So if we're doing something that is riskier and might generate more respiratory aerosols, then we would be switching into a respirator instead of a mask. So unfortunately, that's a lot of getting in and out different types of personal protective equipment. And when we're in settings where we're forced to reuse like this in ways that we don't usually, you could run the risk of contaminating yourself. So we need to be very, very careful while we're providing care.
The number to join this conversation is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Are you a healthcare worker who's experiencing shortages? Are you tired? Are you worried? What do you want people to know about what your work looks and feels like now? Call us and join this conversation. We've got Joel on the line with a question from Jamaica Plain. Joel, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to know how come there's no information anywhere, very little, about the use of intravenous vitamin C to treat coronavirus. Dr. Andrew Weber, who is a pulmonologist and a critical care specialist affiliated with two Northwell health facilities on Long Island, says his attention care patients with the coronavirus immediately receive intravenous vitamin C 3 or 4 times a day, and this does tremendous things for them.
All right.
And in China, the government is experimenting with intravenous vitamin C, and the results are amazingly successful.
Thanks for that call, Joel. Let's turn to Dr. Sharon Wright. Are you aware of research or evidence around the use of, or the practice of using vitamin C?
I had not heard of it specifically for coronavirus, but I guess what I would say is there are a number of pharmaceutical agents, including regular pharmaceuticals, that are being explored to treat this. And some things that we thought, certain antiviral agents that we thought would be useful initially, have shown not to be so. And I think there are a lot of things that people have been mentioning, things to take and things to avoid, like ibuprofen, that I think it's important that we wait for the science before we go there. That being said, there are a number of clinical trials that are going on around the country, and specifically in Boston, that will hopefully give us some more information very quickly.
Now, because you mentioned ibuprofen, let me just ask you to clarify. Are you saying there's something people need to know about ibuprofen, or are you saying that there was a rumor about ibuprofen and it is not accurate?
There isn't sufficient data at this time to support that taking ibuprofen would blunt your immune response to coronavirus. And so I think all of us would await more data on that, and the data that exists so far is not strong. And so I think I was just trying to tamp down on some of the rumors about ibuprofen that are out there, and think if people need it, that they should take it. And if they're concerned about that and they're just using it for fever reduction, if they're feeling ill for any cause, then there are other medications you can try first, like acetaminophen, but there's no data that's strong on that right now.
Let's turn to Bruce in Wrentham. Bruce, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I keep hearing from medical professionals
please don't use surgical masks if you're walking around in public. Yet, every time that I look on the TV or I look at the front page of the local paper, I see somebody with a surgical mask on, and they're not in hospital. They're in public. So what's the story? What should we be doing as public concerning surgical masks?
Thanks for that, Bruce. And Nadia Abuelazan, I'm going to turn to you to both answer that and maybe put it in the context of how people should be processing information they're receiving right now about do's and don'ts in general.
Sure. I mean, my understanding of masks, and again, I'm always happy to hear what Dr. Wright's thoughts are, is that masks will prevent the transmission to someone else should you be feeling ill. So if you're coughing, if you have symptoms, wearing a mask may help the transmission to someone else. I know that a lot of the messaging at the beginning of the epidemic was that you do not have to wear a mask to protect yourself. I imagine that that is still true, although obviously masks have a different function in a healthcare setting. I think it's really important to always turn back to the science. And I think we're sort of seeing this messaging even coming from people like Dr. Tony Fauci. We really always want scientific evidence to be motivating our practices, our do's and our don'ts. And so referring to, you know, the literature whenever it's available, I think is a really good practice. And hopefully, as epidemiologists and clinicians, we can translate that literature for the public.
I'd like to try to turn to one more call before we go. We've got Allison on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts. Allison, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Please go ahead.
Good. Yeah, very quickly. I know we're short on time. And I'm a talker, so I'll shut up. my only question is, I've got stage 4 kidney cancer. I'm very I tested negative for COVID-19, thanks to my oncologist. I just want to know, I've heard so many crazy rumors from so many people because my part-time job is in a grocery store, so I'm still working, which is great. But my main concern is, where do I go for reliable information? Because I've heard so many crazy things, and I'm not really – I just want the facts.
All right. Well, you know, we'll see if we can find that out for you, Allison. I also want to say I'm sorry about your kidney diagnosis, and I'm pleased that you are not positive for COVID-19. So, Dr. Wright, thoughts for the sourcing for Allison of quality information?
Absolutely. So I think the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as the Massachusetts DPH, have very good materials on their websites. They also have specific patient-facing materials that might be a little bit easier to digest than some of the materials that are put out for healthcare providers. Additionally, I don't know where you get your healthcare, but most of the facilities in the Boston area have on their hospital websites put out patient-related material. I know that Beth Israel Lahey Health has put out materials, including for home care for patients who are encouraged to stay at home if they're not feeling well, whether or not they were tested. And also for their caregivers. And so I think those places, as well as contacting your primary care provider for materials they might be able to provide, are probably the most reliable.
And that's Dr. Sharon Wright, Senior Medical Director of the Division of Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Thanks, Dr. Wright.
Thank you.
And Nadia Abuelazam, Assistant Professor at the Connell School of Nursing at Boston College and an epidemiologist. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And before we go, we want to turn to Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. Congressman Moulton is in self-isolation at his home in Salem after experiencing what he says are symptoms consistent with the coronavirus. Congressman Moulton, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Let me start by asking you, how are you?
Now, I'm doing well. My wife and I are both symptomatic for COVID-19, but we seem to have relatively minor symptoms compared to people who are, of course, struggling in hospitals right now. To give people an idea of what that means, we've both experienced tightness in the chest, shortness of breath, particularly when, just doing something as simple as walk up the stairs. Body aches and pains, fatigue, fever, although my senior fever has been pretty minor. The doctors have said this is completely consistent with COVID-19. But the thing is, there's not really a treatment, as you know. There's not some medicine that they would prescribe. And as a result of that, the prescription is just to stay at home and to rest as much as you can, eat well and try to do what you can to keep your immune system in tip-top shape. And so that's what we've been doing.
When you released the news, Congressman Moulton, I heard a lot of reaction from people of dismay that you were not able to get tested. Were you surprised to not be able to get tested, and how are you feeling about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is terrible. The fact that we're actually symptomatic and we can't get tested, when we know that there are a lot of people who are asymptomatic and are actually testing positive, Senator Rand Paul being perhaps the most noteworthy example. So the fact that we still don't have enough tests to give two people who are symptomatic with this disease a test just shows how far behind we are. You know, I actually talked to three different doctors. I talked to a friend who's an ER doc, used to work at Beth Israel. Now he's down south. He immediately, when I started describing, didn't even get through the full description of my symptoms, and he said, you need to go get tested. But then the doctors I talked to up here in Massachusetts and then one in Washington, D.C., said, you know, we just don't have enough tests. So that's the problem.
I want to stay with that for a minute. You know, for example, all of the Boston Celtics NBA players were tested after being exposed to someone who had tested positive. Other people are experiencing, we hear, quite severe symptoms and are in self-isolation and are not receiving tests. There is a core equity issue here. How do we address it?
It's a major equity issue. And I didn't want to use my influence as a member of Congress to say I get a test and take that test away from someone who needs it more. So that's why, you know, as much as I personally, my wife and I would like to just confirm this diagnosis, know for sure. You know, we want to be respectful of the guidelines that are out there and not take tests from someone else. And, you know, we need to do a better job in the future of making sure we truly do have equity in healthcare. But obviously that's not the case right now. I mean, that's why people like me are such advocates for improving Obamacare, for expanding healthcare access, for making sure that healthcare truly is a human right, not a right of the privileged.
There's a big vote tomorrow in the House. Will you miss it?
Yes. I mean, that's a big part of why we disclose this, because if we have to vote in Washington, I'll miss it. Now, the current plan is to pass this by voice vote, which means that in theory, we don't need to all be there. Now, if that doesn't go well, if it doesn't pass, if there's significant objection, then I'm not sure what they're going to do next. But this just highlights the fact that we haven't done enough planning as a government to know how to successfully make it through a pandemic like this and make sure that government keeps operating the way it's supposed to. This is the largest stimulus bill in American history. I mean, you should reserve voice votes for things that are truly inconsequential, not for the largest stimulus bill in American history. So, I support the legislation. I would vote for it if I were in Washington. But I also think we've got to figure out how to do this better so that representatives can truly, you know, voice the concerns and the issues of their constituents and truly have a vote on things like this rather than let them just sort of pass on their own.
We had Congresswoman Lori Trahan on yesterday, who had been part of a group advocating for changes that would allow, for example, remote voting. And we know that Massachusetts, member of the Massachusetts delegation, Congressman McGovern, head of the Rules Committee, has essentially said that's just not doable, especially in this time frame. Do we have a major constitutional need here for Congress that even if we can't address for this pandemic needs to get addressed now?
We do need to address this without question. And, you know, my position is actually kind of between the two, because I agree that at a time like this, remote voting should absolutely be on the table. But I also understand Congressman McGovern's concerns that, among other things, remote voting can be a slippery slope. First, we're remote voting for COVID-19. Next, we're remote voting because it's just more convenient. And suddenly it's one day a week and then 2 days a week and more. And the problem is that one of the only things that keeps a semblance of bipartisan cooperation in Congress is the fact that we have to come together to vote. So I know it's very inconvenient for representatives to fly in from Hawaii and Alaska and everywhere else to come to Congress to take their votes, but I actually think it's very important for the functioning of the institution. So we have to put very strict limits on any sort of remote voting. In fact, I didn't sign on to the letter that Congressman Trahan joined just because, although I think remote voting should be on the table, I didn't think the limits on it, as advocated for in that letter, were sufficient.
You talked a moment ago about bipartisan cooperation. It was remarkable that this bill, the vote we're talking about tomorrow is for the $2 trillion economic aid package, and it did pass unanimously in the U.S. Senate, which doesn't happen very often anymore. What is the lesson that we take from that, and are you satisfied with the provisions in that bill?
Well, the lesson is that it's a pretty good balance. We've come a long way from the initial Senate Republican draft, which I had strong objections to. My priorities are very clear, and I've laid them out. There's four priorities. Number one has to be hospital workers, nurses, and doctors on the front lines. The fact that we still don't have basic protective equipment for the frontline warriors in this fight is just absurd in the wealthiest country on earth. The second priority has to be supporting workers and their families, people who have already lost their jobs. I'm sure you know people who've lost their jobs already. I'm amazed by the number of friends I have who've already been laid off. We need to provide support to them and their families. Third, we need to support small businesses. They're the lifeblood of our economy. They're so critical to our community, and they account for 50% of employment in America. And many of them just don't have the big balance sheets that large corporations have to see their way through this crisis. And then only after those top three should we be talking about any sort of industry bailouts for the airline industry or anywhere else. And I've made it also very clear that industry bailouts need to be accompanied with very strict restrictions. You're going to use taxpayer money. We're going to make you follow values. So I actually think that we're pretty close to that. You know, the Senate Republican draft kind of did everything in the opposite order. It prioritized corporate bailouts and didn't provide any support for hospitals. But this bill comes much closer, and I think that's why it's gotten broad support. I think that Republicans and Democrats also recognize that we've just got to get the support to people as quickly as possible. So it's not perfect. It's not the exact bill that I would have written. But I do support it because I think we've got to get it out the door. We've got to help people as quickly as we can. We all know how the speed, the incredible pace at which this virus is expanding.
In our last 30 seconds or so, Congressman, as I'm listening to you, I'm mindful of the fact that you're having this conversation with me while you are experiencing acute symptoms of the coronavirus, that you're uncomfortable, that you're at home, that you and your wife don't really know what happens right over the next day or two. I know there are other listeners who are afraid or maybe in the same position. What is your advice? What are your words for our listeners?
The most important thing I want to share is that, you know, this is going to affect an awful lot of people, but the reactions to it are going to be incredibly varied. And of course, if you're truly having trouble breathing, you need to go to the hospital and get care. But the majority of cases will be minor. They'll be more like what my wife and I are experiencing. And you've still got to take them seriously. You got to take care of yourself. The only weapon we really have is our own immune system. So make sure it's in tip-top shape. But then also really follow these social distancing guidelines. Adhere to the self-quarantine because you got to get better. But you also have to make sure you're not spreading this to anybody else.
Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, we wish you a speedy recovery.
Thanks so much.